Well, this week, even though it is a leap year where Matos and Masse are frequently separate, but we have both together, and with that we bring our investigations into Chumash Bamidbar to close. And I'd like to begin by taking a look at a section towards the beginning of Parshas Matos. So this is in Perek Lamed Aleph. Of course, the very first section is about Nedarim and Shavuos. And then we move into the war with Midian. And the way that it's described in the beginning of Perek Lamed Aleph, Vayedaber Hashem Moshe Le'emor, Nekom Nikmas B'nei Yisrael, Me'ez HaMidyonim. Exact the vengeance of the Jewish people from the Midyonim, Achar Te'yosef El Amecha. And after that, you shall pass from this world. Moshe, as we know, and it is said in his praise, he immediately initiates the proceedings for this war, even though he knows that he will then pass on after the war. He doesn't defer, he doesn't procrastinate, but rather sees to things straight away. The pasuk in Vav says, Vayishlach Osam Moshe Elef Lamate, he sends 1,000 from each tribe, and Pinchas, who is really in charge of everything. So to summarize, we've only really just read a couple of psukim, but basically Hashem says, exact the vengeance of Bnei Yisrael from the Midyanim, wage war against the Midyanim. And Moshe chooses people, sends them, and Pinchas is in charge. And this catches the attention of the Medrash Rabbah, because on face value, if we take things as plainly as we can, the war was something that Moshe was told to wage. Hashem says to Moshe, Nekom Nikmas, exact their vengeance. One could say that Moshe is entrusted to oversee things in the most general way, but the most straightforward understanding is that Moshe is to lead the charge himself, to lead the war himself. And this is raised by the Medrash. It's in Bamidbar Rabbah, Parsha Kaf Beis, Siman Dalet. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, Nekom Nikmas. Hashem says to Moshe, exact the vengeance, meaning, or sounds like it means, Ata ba'atzmecha, you personally. V'hu mishalech es acherim, and he sends other people to do it. Ela, the Medrash explains, Mipnei shenisgadel be'eretz Midyan. Moshe spent much time in Midyan. He found refuge in Midyan. Amar Eino Bedin, Moshe says, it is not appropriate, it's not correct, She'ani Meitzer L'misha Osa B'tova, that I should cause distress to someone who did a kindness to me. Hamashal Omer, and then it quotes the famous Moshe, the famous saying, Bor She'shosisa Mimenu, a well from which you have drunk, Al tizrok bo evan, don't throw stones into that well. So Moshe is drunk from the well of Midyan. He shouldn't throw stones. He shouldn't be the one to lead the attack. It's an amazing balance when you think about it, especially in connection with what we mentioned just a moment ago, that Moshe doesn't delay, meaning it's something that needs to happen and Moshe sees to it that it happens as soon as possible. And what's the it? The war against Midyan. So on the one hand, he expedites things, but he doesn't lead the expedition. He's not the one who is in charge practically, because he personally has received from Midyan. It's an amazing, it's such a nuanced to know where to put the emphasis, where to move forward, where to hold back. And still the question may be raised. After all, here we are saying that Moshe feels it's not right for him to lead the war. Well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to think that it's right. Because if it's true that Hashem says nekom nikmas, and if the interpretation, the straightforward meaning is you yourself, so then Hashem has said that you're to do it. So where do these concerns and considerations of derech eretz and it's not right, how does that stand up in the face of a direct order from Hashem? You can't be more moral than Hashem. You can't be more correct in the way to go about things than what has been told to you by HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. But this is why Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, in his famous Sefer Sichos Musar, classic Musar discourses, explains that the depth of what the Medrash is saying is that it is so axiomatically clear to Moshe that he cannot personally lead the charge because of the kindness that he has received from Midian. Therefore, Moshe concludes, there is no doubt that Hashem did not mean for him personally to lead the charge. When Hashem says nekom nikmas, it means see to it and arrange it. But it is inconceivable, given the Derech Eretz breach here, for Moshe to do it himself. It's inconceivable to Moshe that Hashem is telling him to lead it directly. And really, therefore, what Reb Chaim Shmulevitz means to formulate is that this Derech Eretz principle actually functions as a perush of Hashem's words. It is a factor which necessarily leads Moshe to interpret and understand Hashem as saying, you need to see to it, but not directly, indirectly. Any alternative is inconceivable. And that really brings the whole concept of Derech Eretz, and this is really was the point that Rav Chaim Shmulevitz is looking to bring out, to a whole new level. It is not, quote-unquote, just another value that exists within the world of Torah. It's a value that sometimes can lead a person, we're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu, to interpret the words of Torah in its light, because a breach of Derech Eretz is simply not possible. Everything else needs to be understood accordingly. And the point is, that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu meant in the first place, necessarily. And he cites another example, and I think these two really, they go together, just to present this very fascinating idea. In the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar, so we're bringing it to a close, we go back to Parshas Bamidbar itself, where Moshe is told to count Bnei Yisrael, which he does, and then he's told to count Levi. And the tribe of Levi is counted from the age of 1 month. This is in Perek Gimel, Bamidbar Perek Gimel, Pasuk Tesvav. Hashem says to Moshe, Pekod es Bnei Levi, count the sons of Levi, Levi Savosam, Lechbechosam, with their father's families, Kol Zachar, every male, mi ben chodesh v'mala tifgidein, from 1 month upwards. Levi is not like the other tribes. The other tribes, as we know, are counted from the age of 20 and upwards. For Levi, it's from 1 month. And the next pasuk Tet Zayin of Perek Gimel says, Vayifkod osam Moshe counts the Levim, al pi Hashem, based on Hashem's words, Ka'asher tsuva, as he was counted. It's a very interesting pasuk. Hashem, Moshe counts them by the word of Hashem as he was commanded. What do all these phrases mean as they come together? Rashi, citing the Medrash, enlightens us. And once again, we hear a similar theme. Amar Moshe lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe says before Hashem, you're telling me to count for 1 month up. Where are the one-month-old babies? They're at home with their mothers. How am I going to go into every person's tent? Ladas minyan yankeim, to know how many little babies they have. It's not appropriate. It's not modest. It's an invasion of their privacy. That's Moshe's response to counting from a month old. Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to Moshe, Asei ata shelcha, you do your part, v'ani eseh sheli, and I'll do my part. We'll count them together. What does that mean? It means, Halach Moshe, so Moshe goes, v'amad al petach ha'ohel, he goes to the entrance of each tent, but he doesn't go in. Vashchina mikademes lefanav, and the divine presence is already there before him. Uvas kol yotzis mina ohel veomeres kach v'kach tinokos yesh be'ohel. And a heavenly voice comes out from each tent and says, there are such and such young babies from a month old in this tent. And that's why lakach ne'emar al pi Hashem. That, says Rashi, is the explanation that Moshe counted them al pi Hashem, literally by Hashem's mouth, because it was Hashem's mouth who told him how many children they were. He used Hashem to help him count because he couldn't go in. So on the one hand, we see a similar idea. Moshe has given a command. It seems to be a breach of Derech Eretz if it's taken in its straightforward way. And in the end, it doesn't work out that way. But rather, Derech Eretz is taken into account. And in this instance, Moshe says, it's not modest for me to enter their tents. And Hashem says, no, you're not going to enter their tents. Stand by the entrance. I'll tell you how many there were. But what's fascinating here, and why it's so significant to bring this second example, in addition to corroborating the idea, is that it really cements the matter. Why? Because the pasuk which says that Moshe counted them al pi Hashem concludes, Ka'asher tzuva, as he was commanded. What do those words add, as he was commanded? Because one may have thought that this was not as he was commanded. One may have thought that he was commanded to count them himself. He raised an objection, and Hashem made a concession, and in the end, they counted in a different way. But that's why the pasuk is saying no. Moshe's objection, based on Derech Eretz, was axiomatically correct, to the extent that it was clear to him Hashem could not have meant that. And indeed, Hashem apprises him of the true intent. You do your part, I'll do my part. So when they go together in a way that does not violate at all matters of Derech Eretz, that's called Kasher Tzuva. That's how he was commanded in the first place. Moshe used Derech Eretz to explain to him the understanding of what it is that Hashem was commanding. So these are the two classic examples cited by Chaim Shmulevitz. The idea itself really highlights the central significance of Derech Eretz. Needless to say, it will still need to be quantified. What counts as the Derech Eretz concern? To what degree does it count? Obviously, in these two cases, it's Moshe Rabbeinu who knows how to make the cheshbon. Other people may need to seek guidance in that regard. But this is the classic discussion in the Sichos Musar of Moshe's delegation in this episode. Towards the end of the Parsha, we have the section, it's in Perek Lamed Beis, it's a lengthy treatment, lengthy discussion, the episode of Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven. And what the Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven want to do later on, they're joined by half a tribe of Manasseh. They become the two and a half tribes, but during the negotiation, it's just those two, the tribe of Gad and Reuven. And they want to stay on the east side. They've seen pasture there. They have a lot of livestock, and it seems like a good fit for them. Moshe castigates them. How can it be? They're really seceding, it seems, from the Jewish people. They're settling somewhere else. They're not going to be involved in the conquest of the land. And in response to this, they offer to go first, as we know. Nachnu na'avor chalutzim. They offer to go first. And Moshe accepts their offer. We'll yet come back to those psukim. But the phrase that I would like to focus on, which is actually a very well-known phrase, extra contextually here, is in Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Kaf Beis. Perek Lamed Beis, Pasuk Kaf Beis. So we're dropping in right in the middle. Again, we'll come back to expand a bit. But Moshe says, "V'nichbasha ha'aretz lefnei Hashem." So you need to go first to be involved in the war first. The land will be conquered. "Ve'achar tashuvu," and after that you can then return to your homes. "V'hiyisem nikiim mi'Hashem u'mi'Yisrael." You need to be clean and clear vis-a-vis Hashem and vis-a-vis the Jewish people. You need to do the right thing by Hashem. You need to do the right thing by people. Not only to do the right thing, but to be not to be perceived as doing the wrong thing. That's called v'hiyisem nikiyim, which has become understandably, a catchphrase. V'yisem nekiim, v'yisem nekiim, mi'Hashem u'mi'Yisrael. And this really is the source in the Torah, as we'll see, for an institution in halacha, a concern in halacha, which is called Maris Ayin. Maris Ayin, the notion of doing something that appears to the untrained eye to be problematic, or to the onlooker, or to someone who doesn't know all the details. It looks a little bit suspicious. And the Gemara says, Maris Ayin is a concern. There are certain things that it's not a problem, but it looks like a problem. And onlookers will see, etc., and come to their conclusions. And therefore, we say to desist from that. V'yisem nekiim, Hashem and Yisrael, to be in the clear vis-a-vis Hashem and the Jewish people. And I'd like to expand this very, very interesting area, which is called Maris Ayin, just a little bit. We're not coming to Paskan Shilas, but just to get an appreciation of the forces in play. And so we begin with some fascinating examples of Maris Ayin from Chazal. Two or three from Chazal. There are more, but with that we will suffice. For example, just to get a sense of what are the Maris Ayin concerns as perceived by Chazal, there is a Mishnah in Maseches Kilayim. We know that Kilayim is all the forbidden mixtures, not only forbidden mixtures of planting, but also shatnez, wool and linen. And that's what shatnez is, not to wear a garment which contains those two materials. Tzemer ufishtim yachdav, wool and linen. The Mishnah says in Maseches Kilayim, Perek Tes, Mishnah Beis, that one shouldn't wear wool and silk together. If there's a garment with wool and silk, one shouldn't wear it. Why? Because silk is similar looking enough to linen, and therefore, a garment that has a mixture of wool and silk looks like it's a mixture of wool and linen. And that is Maris Ayin. Therefore, one shouldn't wear such a garment. That's the example from Shatnez. Another example from the Gemara. In Maseches Bava Basra, and Davches and Davtes are all, not all, but are devoted to matters of tzedakah, and the procedures for giving tzedakah and for gabay tzedakah. And there's some very interesting halachas that are mentioned there. Among them, the Gemara says, if a gabay tzedakah is going around, and he's collecting for tzedakah, so he's got his kupa, his pushka, and everyone puts their tzedakah in the kupa, in the box. But what if he meets someone who owes him money? They happen to meet. So, oh, I'm happy I saw you. I owe some money. It's been a week already. Please let me pay you now. So the Gemara says, when he accepts payment, I mean, he's allowed to accept payment, but he shouldn't put that money in his pocket, even though it's his money. Because the onlooker doesn't know that this person is giving him money in repayment of a debt. The onlooker sees a gabay tzedakah who's just received a donation from someone and pocketed it. And therefore, for reasons of Maris Ayin, the Gemara says that he should put it in the tzedakah box. He should take note of how much it is. He knows how much it is. Put it in the tzedakah box so he's not seen as pocketing any money while he's collecting for a tzedakah. And when he goes home, he should take subtract that amount from the tzedakah box. It's a very interesting example of Maris Ayin. And moreover, in addition to enactments of Chazal for purposes of Maris Ayin, the Gemara in one place actually explains that the Torah itself has one of its halachas based on Maris Ayin. And this is presented to us by none other than Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai is famous in the Gemara for expounding reasons for mitzvahs, what's called Doresh Taima Dekra. And here too, the Gemara in Masechah Shabbos, Daf Kaf Gimel, it's Tzaita Tosefta, and Omar Rabbi Shimon raises the question, why is it with the mitzvah of Peah, and what is the mitzvah of Peah? The Torah says you've harvesting your field, leave something for the poor. It should be in the corner. Okay. And Reb Shimon Bar Yochai is very interested, and so are we, to know why the Torah stipulates that the part that you leave or the grain that you leave for the poor should be in the corners. Does it make a difference? Is that better quality than in the middle or on the side? Why the corner? And he gives a number of reasons. But one of the reasons, says Reb Shimon Ben Yochai, is mipnei hachashad, to allay suspicion. Suspicion of what? Suspicion that perhaps, the onlooker, people are visiting his field, and they may think if he leaves a different part and no one knows where it is, people may think that he's just completely avoided giving anything to the poor at all. Therefore, the Torah stipulates it is to be the most visible part of the field, should be left for all to see. No one should suspect this person of shirking his responsibilities vis-a-vis the gifts to the poor. You can't miss it. It's the four corners, highly visible. Mipnei hachashad, that's why the Torah says peah, is to be given from the corner. So these already give us a sense of the idea of maris ayin and how sensitive we are to it. And the truth is, and this is important to formulate or to set forth, from a certain point of view, one could say there are two problems that could come from a maris ayin situation. They're almost the opposite to each other in nature, but they're equally problematic. Because by definition, a maris ayin situation is, this isn't really wrong, but the onlooker doesn't know that. So now the critical question is, the onlooker doesn't know the whole situation, and therefore they will conclude what? And here, there are two possibilities. It's almost a T-junction. They part ways in opposite directions. The first is that because the onlooker doesn't realize that this is an acceptable situation, to him it looks like it's an unacceptable situation, he may then come to suspect the person of unacceptable behavior. In other words, with lacking full information, he may come to suspect you of doing the wrong thing. And that you shouldn't do. You should alleviate such concerns. But there is an alternative or a parallel concern in maris ayin. Namely, and it depends on the onlooker and might depend on the situation, it could be that this person, to him, it looks like something that it isn't. And he may therefore think that you're doing the right thing and conclude that this is acceptable. If we see how those two conclusions, they really are the polar opposites from each other. Whatever happens, you lose. Something could go wrong, but it's the opposite thing going wrong. Again, just to summarize, either he, through lack of complete information, he may look at the situation and assume that you're doing, conclude you're doing the wrong thing, or he might look at the situation and conclude you're doing the right thing and then himself do the wrong thing, because Plony did it. He didn't realize that what you're doing is okay. And in fact, if we put names to faces, just the two examples that we cited earlier, one could say each one is an illustration of these two branches of maris ayin. The idea of the gabbai tzedakah, if he collects a debt while he's collecting for tzedakah, he shouldn't put it in his pocket because of maris ayin. There, it's very clear that the concern is that no one will look at the gabbai tzedakah and say, oh, I guess he's stealing from tzedakah. I suppose that's acceptable. No one will think that's acceptable. The conclusion will clearly be that this person is doing the wrong thing. So there, we're worried that we don't want him to be suspected of doing the wrong thing. But sometimes, for example, moving into the kilayim situation, the shatnas situation, it could be that a person is not so versed or lettered in the halachas, and therefore you're wearing a garment of wool and silk, which is completely okay. To the onlooker, it might look like wool and linen. you are a nice from Jew, good from Jew. He might therefore conclude, well, Reb so-and-so was wearing that woolen linen. I had heard somewhere that that wasn't okay, but apparently it is okay. In other words, because he thinks that you're doing the right thing, a mishap could occur. So these are the two branches of Maras Ayin. Now, there is a case, and here it's important also to interject. Here we are saying a person should always allay suspicion from themselves. One may ask an indignant question. Isn't it incumbent upon the onlooker to judge me favorably? Isn't it wrong for him to suspect that I'm doing the wrong thing? Why should I have to bear the burden of his negative conclusions? That's a fair question. And the truth is, yes, he should be done the kapsuchus. The reality is, there's a good chance that he won't be. And especially if the situation looks somewhat suspicious, therefore, the onus is also on the protagonist to allay suspicion from himself and to make it clear that he's not doing anything wrong and avoid a situation where it looks like he is doing something wrong. Now, closer to our time, a Maris Ayin situation, which is discussed in Shulchan Aruch by the Ramah and the commentaries, related to the question of milk substitutes. In the Ramah's time, in addition to milk itself, milk, they already had milk that they would make from almonds, which is, of course, completely parv. And the question now is it acceptable to serve and to use effectively this parv milk with a meat meal? And is that okay? And the consensus of the poskim has two parts to it. Number one, no, it's not okay because it looks a lot like milk. It looks exactly like milk. And therefore, once again, either you'll be suspected of having milk inflatiates, which is a terrible thing to be suspected of, or alternatively, someone who visits your house and you're a firm Jew, they may say, oh, well, they served coffee with milk after the cholent, and therefore, apparently, it's acceptable. Therefore, it should be avoided. However, the follow-up part to this, which is also in the Ramah, is that what if you can do something to make it abundantly clear that this is not actual milk? Now, what is it that you would do? Says the Ramah, simple. Put some almonds on the table next to the milk. People know that there exists the concept of almond milk. They will not naturally assume that this is such. But if you can add what's called a hecker, some way of making it noticeable and clear that this is not a problematic thing, so then your Maris Ayin questions have been solved. Now, what's both of these things are significant in this case. The first thing that's significant is this whole idea of power of milk is not discussed in the Gemara. Often we have a concept that when it comes to preventative measures and enactments, we have what we have in Chazal, from the Mishnah and the Gemara, and we don't add on to it. But here we see that in Maris Ayin, it's dynamic. We will add on to it. Why? Because we go for the principle. The principle is v'hiyisem nekiyim me'Hashem u'mi'Yisrael, avoid suspicion. Which means if something happens that could be suspicious, even though in the times of the Gemara, maybe they didn't have milk substitutes, so it wasn't a concern. But it's a concern now. And if it's a concern now, the ongoing requirement of v'yisem nikiyim can result in new situations which are not discussed in the Gemara at all. That's the first thing that needs to be noted. But the second thing is, sometimes a Maris Ayin situation can be remedied. Or it's not even a question of remedied, it can be mitigated by having a hecker. By somehow making it abundantly clear that this is not a problematic situation, then your Maris Ayin concerns are gone. That idea of making it clear through a hecker, through some type of accompanying thing that shows that this is not a problematic situation, that actually is in the Gemara. Not with regards to milk, but actually with regards to fish blood, which I don't think is much of a topic lately, because fish blood, I guess, is not most people's cup of tea. But fish blood is actually completely kosher. But once again, it looks a lot like blood. And therefore, is it acceptable to have it? I mean, it looks like a person's eating blood, eating long kosher. And this is a Gemara in Maseches Krisus. And the Gemara says, if you have some fish scales local, so then once again, what are you doing? You are atmospherically showing that this is a permitted substance, and therefore it's okay. So that idea actually is the idea of the hecker is based on the Gemara, and it was applied to the almond milk. Take some almonds, put them around. Everyone understands it's almonds all around, and then it will be mutter. But what is the converse of this idea? Because here we are saying that we need to update, so to speak, and say what is suspicious nowadays. If something wasn't a suspicious situation in the times of the Gemara, but it has become so, we need to take note of it. But what if the opposite is true? What if something in the times of the Gemara was suspicious, but is no longer suspicious? Then what? And this question is discussed by the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, in Hilchos Kilayim. And the Rosh says a startling thing, and it's Paskin and Shulchan Aruch. The Rosh says, remember the Mishnah which says you shouldn't wear a garment with wool and silk, because it looks a lot like wool and linen, therefore you shouldn't do it. Says the Rosh, in our time, it's permitted. It is no longer a problem to wear a garment with wool and silk. The Mishnah says it's a problem. How can the Rosh say it's not a problem? The Rosh explains himself. In the times of the Mishnah, silk was not so common. It wasn't so commonly used either by itself or together with other materials, which means that if you had silk, people would naturally assume that it's not silk. They assumed that it's linen. However, in our time, says the Rosh, silk has been much more prevalent, it's much more on the market, it's much more used, which means if a person sees something, it's easier to identify, it looks like silk, and no one will say, oh, that must be linen, because it's just as likely to be silk. And we don't assume, if it doesn't look questionable anymore, we don't assume that there's an issue of maris ayin. So this really is a very significant ruling, because what the Rosh is saying is in the same way as we introduced, in the same way that new cases of maris ayin can come up, old cases can recede depending on circumstance. And this leads to an interesting question, because it comes back to the issue of milk substitutes. In the times of the Ramah, if we apply the logic that we just saw in the Shatnez case, why not say the same thing? Why not say that if you have something that looks like milk, well, people will assume that it's okay. People will assume that it's not milk. Apparently, it wasn't so common to have milk substitutes. So which means all things being equal, the preponderance is that it is milk, and that's why it looks problematic. But what if it should become equally prevalent to have milk substitutes? And that seemingly would be the situation in our times. Milk substitutes abound. You have a lot of people who are lactose intolerant, and for them, it's all milk substitutes. And there's many people that, for some reason, even if they're not lactose intolerant, I think they just might be lactose ambivalent. And they also go for these substitutes. So it's a very common thing. You'll find it in every makalet. And applying, therefore, the logic of the Shatnez case, perhaps it's completely permitted and one shouldn't even need a hecker. It's just as soon as you have something that looks like milk, it is so ubiquitous to have milk substitutes that people will naturally assume that it's okay, just like they assume that the silk is silk. They don't think it's linen. And this question is discussed by Rav Asher Weiss in his Tshuvas. And although he certainly considers this possibility, nonetheless, he advises still to err on the side of caution. For most people, milk is still milk. However, having said that, we shouldn't forget that the option of making it clear through a hecker should be acceptable for milk substitutes as for anything else, which means practically that all one needs to do is to bring the container to the table which basically advertises that it's not milchik of whatever it is. And there's your hecker. If almonds were good enough for almond milk, so the container which says non-dairy is good enough for your non-dairy creamer or milk or whatever it is. So these are very interesting themes and concerns with regards to Maris Ayin. We'll just conclude with probably what one could call the most extreme case of Maris Ayin, and to discuss or try and understand why it's so extreme, why it's dealt with such hypersensitivity. And that is the way in which the Machzis HaShekel, the half shekel coins, were taken initially from the treasury to be used for korbanos. There was a whole ceremony and there was a whole procedure that the Kohen would go in and he would take, he'd be in the room, in a room full of half shekel coins. And this is in the days when half a shekel was worth money. And the Mishnah in Maseches Shekalim describes, and it's quite surprising if you've never heard of it. Says the Mishnah, the Kohen who would go in order to take from the Machzis HaShekel, that first scoop, he had to be dressed in a certain way. His clothing could not have pockets or hems. Absolute, material-wise, transparency. He was not allowed to wear shoes. Why? Because what if subsequently this person becomes poor? What will people say? Ah, you know, I became poor. He probably helped himself to a bit of the Trumas HaLishka, helped himself to some of those half shekels. This is his comeuppance. Alternatively, what if he becomes rich? What will people say? The same people will say the opposite. Ah, well, of course, where do you think he got his money from? He made a fortune in collecting half shekels. A few went here, a few went there, a few between the soles of his shoes and then the hems, and between one thing and another, he came out loaded. In order that people shouldn't say that, he doesn't wear shoes, he wears a special type of clothing where there's no possibility. So much so that the Mishnah goes on further. The Yerushalmi discusses this. All the while that he is collecting from the half shekel coins, one version is they keep him in conversation. Why? To ensure that he doesn't put some coins in his mouth. So they keep him talking. And in fact, the Yerushalmi in Shekalim discusses this matter from another point of view. Because there's an interesting shaila. Namely, do you make a bracha before you take from the half a shekel? I mean, it seems like it's part of a mitzvah. And the Gemara says, Yerushalmi says an amazing thing. Maybe in principle you should make a bracha before collecting from that chamber with all those half shekel coins. It's the beginning of a mitzvah. Maybe. But Lamaisa, the Kohen did not make a bracha when he collected those coins. Why not? Says the Yerushalmi, Mipnei HaMayim. Because of the water. What water? Mefarshim on the Yerushalmi explain that according to the Yerushalmi, they would fill his mouth with water. And when he left, he would have to empty all the water to ensure that he wouldn't put any money in his mouth. This is very extreme. And when you think about it, it actually is antithetical to everything that we've said. Because we've said that okay, a person shouldn't bring suspicion upon themselves, but to act in a completely normal way. I mean, here we're going to absolute extremes to allay such suspicion. And Rav Asher Weiss explains that the reason is, presumably, because here we're dealing with a high-profile event. Very public, representing the entire Jewish people, the money of the entire Jewish people. In other words, a person, as he goes about his own business, you can rely on a certain latitude with people. As long as you're not acting suspiciously or doing something which looks suspicious, people will give you the benefit of the doubt. But it is often the nature of public events. And when it's a public event, the public has what to say. And the more public it is, the more they have what to say. There seems to be a kind of a Parkinson's law that governs public commentary, where the more people there, the more possibilities there are as to what it is that this person may have done wrong. And that is why we protect him from any suspicion in such extreme measures. Either way, these are some, as we say, of the very, very interesting, and questions go up again. We're not coming to Paschen Shilas. These are questions that relate to, for example, having a business lunch in a workplace, which is if the restaurant is non-kosher, is it understood that this is where people meet for lunch, and therefore the onlooker will not think otherwise? Does a person need to have a hecker? How these things work? All of these things are discussed by the Poskim. But certainly a very, very interesting sugya. There's more to Maris Ayin than meets the eye. That is for sure. Within the parsha of Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven, to move back from the halacha into the parsha itself. So as we know, if we could summarize it briefly and then see where we go from there. They initially asked to stay on the east side. Moshe says, you're not going to go into the war. So then they offer to go first. And then Moshe accepts their offer and they accept his acceptance. And then Moshe repeats it. And then it happens. It really goes back and forth quite a number of times. And it's very easy at a certain point to stop noticing what exactly is being said, because we assume that what's being said the second time is effectively what was said the first time, largely. But there's a very interesting comment of the Sforno on the final pasuk. And this final pasuk is, so we are in Perek Lamed Beis, pasuk Lamed Gimel. There's still a few pasukim towards the end, but Moshe finally initiates this agreement. Vayitain lahem perek lamed beis pasuk lamed gimel. Vayitain lahem Moshe l'bnei Gad v'bnei Reuven. He gives Bnei Gad v'bnei Reuven chatzi shevet Menashe ben Yosef. He gives them all of these places, Mamlecha Sichon Melech Omeri, and the kingdom of Og Melech HaBashan, and so on and so forth. So this is when it finally happens. The Sforno comments on the words Vayitain lahem Moshe. Moshe gave them, says the Sforno, Kidei shelo lihikonis b'machlokas. In order not to get involved in machlokas, Hiskim Moshe lidivrehim. Moshe agreed to what they said. Now, these words are very obscure, because the pasuk describes that Moshe did what he said he would do. This is as per the agreement. Yet somehow the Sforno looks at this final pasuk where it actually happens, and the Sforno says Moshe doesn't want to get involved in a machlokas, so he goes with what they want. Presumably by this stage everyone wants the same thing. So to what is the Sforno alluding? What is it that Bnei Gad, Bnei Reuven wanted, that Moshe gave them in this final stage to avoid machlokas? And this now beckons us to go back to the Psukim and see more closely what is being said. So if we start with Pasuk Tet Zayin. And if as we read the Psukim and we're sensitive to these differences, things will really become apparent to us. They say, we'll create enclosures for our livestock and our children. We know that was a mistake for them to put one before the other. We will then go first, ad asher im havyonum amukamam, until we've installed them in their place. V'yashav tapeinu barei hamivtzar, our children will be in these fortified cities, mipnei yoshvei haaretz. Pasuk yud ches, lo nashuv abateinu adis nachel b'nei Yisrael ish nachaloso. We won't come back until the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael proper on the west side have had their inheritance. And now, pasuk yud tes, Ki lo ninchalitam. We will not inherit with them. Me'eva la'yarden v'hala. On the other side of the yarden, on the west side. Ki va'a nachalaseinu eleinu. Me'eva ha'yarden mizracha. Because our inheritance has come to us on the east side. Ba'a nachalaseinu. Rashi comments. Kvar kibalnuha. We have already received it. We won't inherit with them on the west side. We will have already received our inheritance on the east side. So that's their offer. So far, more or less as we would ourselves say it. But what does Moshe say? Pasuk kaf, vayomar lihem Moshe, im tasunas hadavar hazeh, im teichatzun lefnei Hashem lemelchama. Indeed, if you will go before Hashem into war, v'avar lechem kol chalutz es hayarden lefnei Hashem, all of you will cross the yarden, ad harisho es hayvav mipanav, until he dispossesses the enemy. And now, pasuk kaf peis, v'nichbesha ha'aretz lefnei Hashem, the land will be conquered before Hashem. Va'achar tashuvu, then you shall return. Ve'yisem nikiyim mi'Hashem u'mi'Yisrael, the pasuk that we spoke about with regards to Maras Ayin. And then what does Moshe say? V'haysa ha'aretz hazos lachem la'achuza lefnei Hashem. This land on the east side will be for you a holding, which is not exactly the word that they used, but this will be your portion before Hashem. Moshe seems to be accepting what they said, but he isn't. Because while he accepts their offer to go first in the war, he differs from them in that they're saying, we're going first in the war, but we want already from now to receive this portion as a nachala. Ki ba'a nachalaseinu, to already have received it. Moshe says, no. If you fulfill the condition, then v'haysa ha'aretz hazos lachem la'achuza, then you will receive it. Not before. So Moshe is not accepting everything that they're saying. He's accepting their offer, but not their terms. So now what? Do B'nai Gad and B'nai Reuven accept Moshe's rejection of their request to already have this land as a Nachala? Let's see. What do they say? Pasuk Kafhei. Vayomer b'nei Gad u'b'nei Reuven el Moshe le'mor, avadecha yasu kasher adoni mitzaveh. We'll do as you command us. Tapeinu nashenu mekneinu v'chol b'emteinu, yusham be'ar Gilad. Our families will be there, will be living there. Vavadecha yavru kol chalutz tzava lefnei Hashem le'melchama. And we will then go forward in the war, kasher adoni daber, as you say. This is very interesting. Because they actually have only reiterated half of what is being discussed. They have only spoken about, are they prepared to go to war first? And they are. But they have already dropped the question or omitted any reference to the question as to whether they will receive the Nachala already or not, or only afterwards. They don't talk about it one way or the other. And for the Sforno, this is really these two tribes' way of indicating that they were not accepting this stipulation of Moshe. So if initially they said, we'll go first and we want the Nachala already, and Moshe counters and says, you go first and then you'll get the Nachala, and now they say, we'll do what you say, we'll go first in the war, and they don't talk about anything else because they're not prepared to ratify, they're not prepared to concur with the other thing that Moshe says, that they will only receive the Nachala afterwards. So this is now, it's a bit of a tense situation. And that is why Moshe doesn't leave it like that. Because when he reiterates again, he makes sure to bring this idea in. It should not go unspoken. It needs to be spoken, it needs to be concurred with. And that's why in Pasuk Kafches, which is already the fourth Hakafa now, Vayitzav la Moshe, es Elazar HaKohen. And what does he say? Pasuk Kavtes, Vayomer Moshe Alehem, says to Elazar and to Yeshua, Im Yavru b'nei Gad uv'nei Reuven etchem es hayarden. If they will cross the yard in Kol Chalutz l'melchama lefnei Hashem, they will go first in the war, v'nich b'sha ha'aretz lefneichem, and the land will be conquered, then Unisatem lahem es eretz hagilad la'achuzah. Then give them the gilad as the achuzah, like I said originally, once it's been done, not from the outset. They didn't refer to it one way or the other. It shouldn't be misunderstood. And B'nai Gad B'nai Reuven here, it's amazing to track it in this way. They don't accept it. Initially, they thought they'd get away with just not talking about it either way. But Moshe says, no, we will talk about it. So B'nai Gad B'nai Reuven says, okay, we'll talk about it. We demand the Achuza now. It's amazing that they come with demands, because one would have thought they're on the weaker side. I mean, they're not really negotiating from a position of strength here. All things being equal, they're not meant to be staying on the east side in the first place. So to be standing on their demands is very interesting. But that's what they say. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, the final part of the negotiation, and they, in a sense, they have the final word. Conversation-wise, Vayanu b'nei Gad b'nei Reuven lemor, Eis asher diber Hashem el avadecha, kein aseh. We will do what Hashem tells you for us to do. We will do, namely, Nachnu navor chalutzim lefnei Hashem eretz Kanan. We will go first. But ve'itanu achazas nechalaseinu. But our inheritance will be with us, meaning we will already own it as we're going forward. And now the question is, how long is this going to go on for? How many back and forth is it going to happen? They say we want it already. Moshe says, no, only afterwards. No, we're not talking about it. We are talking about it. Okay, let's talk about it. We want it now. And what happens in the end? Amazingly, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Vayitein Lehem Hashem. Moshe gives it to them. And that now enters the Sforno and says, Kedei Shelo Likanis B'machlokas Hiskim Moshe L'divrayim. After all of that emphasizing and stipulating that it will only be yours afterwards, Moshe perceives, and he's not prepared to remain, I would say, admired in his position simply because it's his position and he's Moshe Rabbeinu. He does an amazing thing. And that is, Moshe says, actually, this, if it's so important to you, it's not critical to what we're talking about. My preference is that you don't get it until afterwards. If you are so insistent, I'm not going to make a thing of it. Even though we just spent the last 15 psukim going through yes, no, yes, no. But in the end, says Moshe, it's not worth it. It's an amazing lesson. Because Moshe could very easily say, I'm Moshe Rabbeinu, deal with it. And if you don't like it, so then what are you doing on the east side in the first place? But the notion of how accommodating Moshe is as to the extent possible for this suggestion, even to the extent of backing away from something that he originally said, if he feels it could lead to machlokas in an unhealthy way and it's not worth it, that's the judgment that Moshe makes. Incredible comment of the Sforno. And again, new eyes with which to look at these 30-odd psukim. Because that's now a lesson ledoros. How many times do we stay with our original position where it's no longer even that important or never was the critical point just because that was our opening position or that's what we said, and therefore many things will be overturned before we would back away from our original position. That's a lesson from Moshe Rabbeinu. Well, we've been in Parshas Matos for most of this evening. We just have a few minutes left for something from Maaseh, and it's really at the end. And it comes back to the daughters of Tzelafchad. It's a classic comment. It's really impossible even to how to characterize it. It's so incredible. From the Maaseh LeDavid. And the final section of Parshas Maaseh is the tribe of Yosef complains. If the daughters of Tzelafchad, if they inherit and they marry from other tribes, so then the inheritance of Tzelafchad will exit the tribe because it will go after the tribe of their husband. That's why the Takana at that time was that they, in that first generation, they should only marry from their own tribe of Yosef. And that is described in Maftir of Parshas Maaseh, which says, Batihyena machla tirtza v'chagla umilka v'noa b'no Tzelafchad livnei dodehen l'nashim. They all married from their cousins, that is to say, from the tribe of Yosef, and everyone was happy. This is the third time that Tzelafchad's daughters are mentioned by name. They are mentioned twice in last week's parsha, in Pinchas. And Rashi notes that the order changes from how they're referred to twice in Pinchas and how they're referred to here. And Rashi explains the background to the change in order. Says Rashi, Kan mena'an lifnei gedulasam zuba zubashanim. Here, they're ordered in terms of their age. V'nisu kaseidu todosam. They got married in order of their age. U'v'chol ha'mikra, but elsewhere in the Chumash, mena'an lifi chachmasam. They're enumerated and listed in order of their wisdom. Wisest first. And then Rashi says, U'magid sheshkulos zo kazo. This teaches us that they're all equal to each other. So as we can appreciate, again, what have we said to in synopsis? Initially in last week's parsha, the order is different because that's in order of wisdom. Here it's an order of age, and the moral of the story is they're all equal. So firstly, how do we know that the order there is wisdom and the order here is age? Well, it says the Maskil HaDavid very simply, because there the issue is one of wisdom. They're coming with a legal claim. So presumably the wisest one spoke first. You need wisdom if you're coming up against, not approaching Moshe to talk a din Torah with him. Here is about getting married. We assume that whoever's older got married first, and they all got married in rapid succession, and therefore it is an intuitive allocation of the order. There the issue is one of wisdom, wisest first. Here the issue is one of getting married, oldest first. First born, first married. But now, and again, a sub-point before we get to the main point. If we say that they're ordered in terms of their wisdom and in terms of their age, and then we say they're all the same, in what way are they all the same? Maybe you just told me that one of them is wiser than the other, one's older than the other. How are they all the same? They're either different or they're the same. But the Maskil HaDavid says, again, very, very straightforward, that, okay, one is more wise than the other, but when we say they're all the same, that's all the same in terms of they're equally good people, masim tovim in that regard, and that they're the same. But the final question, and with this we'll conclude, says the Maskil HaDavid, how do you know that they're all equal in anything? All we know is that they've been listed in order. Now, normally, if people are listed in order, that means the first one has something over the second. Now, it is true that the order shifts. And sometimes when the order shifts, we say, you know what, the order shifts? To say that the order is not important. Sometimes Moshe is before Aaron, sometimes Aaron is before Moshe, to teach you that the two are the same. Because there's no other way to explain the shift in order. But you just explained the shift in order. You just said there the order is a certain way because we're talking about wisdom. Here, there's a different criteria for the order. So you don't have that dynamic of it just changed the order to teach you that they're the same, because each order has its own concern. So where are we left with the wherewithal to conclude that they are the same in any regard? That's a very interesting question. It's almost like we're trying to take the rope from both ends. You've explained the order in both and say the order doesn't really matter. That's an interesting shaila. Says the Maskil HaDavid, it appears to me that the basis for Chazal, which Rashi quotes, that they're all equal, doesn't come from the fact that the order was shifted. It comes from something else. As we mentioned, these daughters are spoken about three times. The first is in the beginning of Pinchas, Perakap Kafavav Pasuk Lamed Gimel, and it refers to them as Machla Venoa, Chagla Milka Vesirtsa. Fine. Then, when they approach Moshe in Pasuk Perakav Zayin Pasuk Aleph, they are called Machla Noa VeChagla UMilka VeTirtsa. The order is the same, but something shifted. The use of vavs. The first time round, it was Machla and Noah. Chagla, Milka, and Tirtza. The second time around, the order is the same, but it's Machla, Noah, and Chagla, and Milka, and Tirtza. So the Vavs are all over the place. That's an inconsistency. And moreover, when we come to the Pasuk in front of us, which is Mafter of Masei, Perek Lamed Vav Pasuk Yud Aleph, so not only is the order different, but again, the Vavs, Machla, Tirtza, Vichagla, Vimilka, Vinoah. So what is the mahalach here? What determines when a vav is used and when it isn't? Because it seems to be inconsistent. Says Maskele David, you'll note something fascinating. Machla is mentioned first in all cases. I guess she was the oldest and the wisest, so that's that. But by the Torah using the vavs the way that it does, if you look at all these three psukim together, you'll see something fascinating. The result of the way the vavs are used is that each of the other four daughters in one of the psukim is mentioned without a vav beforehand, before her name. When should you have a vav when you follow someone? When do you not have the letter vav? When you're first. If you look through these three times five, meaning the three iterations of the daughters of Tzelafchan, each one after Machla, in one of those times, aside from the order, which is wisdom or years, she gets her moment where she's not introduced to the vav. If you're not introduced to the vav, that means you could be first. Which of them could be first? All of them, because they're all equal with regards to Masim Tovim or whatever it is. So literally to the letter, we finish Chumash Bamidbar, we have the sweeping discussions, the halachic discussions, and then the attention to detail, with a vav, without a vav. Like the earlier Pasuk, not like the earlier Pasuk. Look at them all together. What's the picture that emerges? And that's truly, it's an education in terms of what we call learning Chumash. And that, I think, is a fitting note through Limud Torah to finish the shiur for this evening. Chazak, chazak, b'nes chazek. We'll see you, mitzvah Hashem, next week. We should have besuras tovos, yeshuas, v'nechamas, bekarov. All the very best.